Okay, so we'll start back up. We don't have that much time left, so I'm giving myself a huge challenge because this is probably one of the most complex arguments for God's existence, and I'm going to try to do all of it within an hour, less than an hour, so we'll see if we get this done. But just as a general introduction, the arguments that we've looked at so far are called cosmological arguments because what those do is they point to some feature of the world that it's argued cries out for an explanation, whether it's motion or whether it's the universe having a beginning or whether it's just the universe being contingent, and says the best explanation for that is in terms of a being that's a very close match to God, right? It's metaphysically necessary, it's incredibly powerful, it has to be spaceless, timeless, and contingent, all the rest of it. Those are cosmological arguments. The next kind of argument we're going to look at is completely different in its strategy, and it's called an ontological argument. Every other argument for God's existence is in some way going to point to some feature of the world and say, this is best explained by reference to God, or with reference to God. An ontological argument puts aside entirely every feature of the world. Doesn't matter what the world is like. What matters is the very concept of God. And so the idea is that we can actually, if we're careful enough about it, if we're careful enough about doing conceptual analysis on it, you'll be able to see that from the very concept of God, you can prove God's existence. You don't need any features of the world to do it. This is the kind of argument that philosophers get accused of. This is like a philosopher's trick, or that's a lot of people's intuition about this argument. So what I'll do is I'll try to just lay it out for you guys. But I do want to say, as a preamble, even if you think the argument is terrible, and there are plenty of philosophers, Christian philosophers, theistic philosophers, who think this argument doesn't really work for various reasons, even if you think it's terrible, this argument, probably more than any other argument for God's existence, is useful in the sense that it helps us get really clear on our concept of God. So with other arguments, you get bits and pieces of what we mean by God's existence, and we're getting closer and closer to the mark. With an ontological argument, you're actually just staring at the mark. You're looking at what it is we mean, really, by saying God, or what it is we mean by saying that God exists. So what's entailed by that very concept? So here the idea is going to be that just as you can prove certain things by reflecting, you can derive certain properties by reflecting on the nature of a thing. So for instance, you can, just thinking about what a triangle is by its very definition, you don't ever have to have seen a triangle. But just knowing what a triangle is and having a concept of it tells you that it does not have seven sides, right? It has three sides. That it has three corners. That its internal angles add up to 180 degrees, right? Now that one, that last one might be a little bit harder to derive, but you can derive it if you're careful about conceptually thinking through what a triangle is, even if you've never seen one before. That's what the ontological argument is going to try to do with respect to God. So what's the concept here of God? This argument is first proposed by St. Anselm of Canterbury, and this is around the, late 11th century. And he comes up with this argument for thinking that you can prove that God exists by carefully thinking through what the concept of God involves, just even as a concept. And he says, so what really is the concept of God? Well, one way to think about what God is just in terms of great making, or what are called great making properties. I'm throwing some of this back onto Anselm instead of just deriving it from him, but if you think about God as a perfect being, right, hypothetically, that's what God is supposed to be, is an absolutely perfect being. One way to figure out what that involves is just to say that there are a bunch of properties in the world. Some of them are what are called great making properties. So if something has that property, it's better than it otherwise would have been. But most of the time, great making properties are contextual, right? You can have a property that makes you really great at baseball or at doing physics or any number of other things, but those aren't really great making properties everywhere, right? They're great making properties with respect to a certain set of goals that you might have. But if you think about the most basic properties that are supposed to be great making, it's plausible at least to think that some properties are great making everywhere and always. So anything that has that property is better than it otherwise would have been in any circumstance, right? So think about the property, for example, of being morally good. That's the kind of property that it's pretty hard to imagine some context in which that counts as a negative, or a context in which it isn't a positive. So that's a kind of great-making property that philosophers call a categorically great-making property. It makes something greater to have it. There's no context in which it makes something less good, given that it has it. And God is supposed to be a perfect being in the sense that he has all and only categorically great-making properties. So what kinds of properties would those be? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Why the only?
So the reason you want it to be only great-making properties is that you may not want to end up with God having mystery properties that don't map onto this kind of greatness feature of God, because if you think of God as just having great-making properties, but not having all and only great-making properties, then it's going to turn out that God has them in such a way that he happens to have them, instead of in such a way that it just falls out from the concept of God. So an ontological...
Yeah, the all made sense. It
right.
Just mean the only.
Yeah, right.
You may not have some other property that is not relevant to greatness.
So let's put it this way. Suppose he has some other property that isn't, it doesn't map onto greatness in this way, right? If God has such a property, then God is more than just a maximally great being. He is a maximally great being, but he happens to be a maximally great being. Maximally great being, or perfect being, wouldn't be the definition of God. It wouldn't be the concept itself. It would just be that whatever God is, he also happens to be, he might have other properties, but he also happens to be perfect and maximally great and so on. But for an ontological argument to work, and this is a good point, you might just get off the boat here, right? You might just say, okay, God is great and all, but that's not what we mean by the word God. But for Anselm, and for people who think this argument works, they're going to say, no, we mean perfect being. That's what we mean when we say the word God. We mean a being that has that is defined in terms of this maximal greatness. That's just what it means to talk about. So it's not a feature that God happens to have, right? And in addition, he's got other features that we can't explain with reference to this definition. This is the definition of God. It's the commanding principle of the concept, right? You want to talk about God meaningfully, according to defenders of this argument, this is where you begin. This is what the word God means. Now, maybe he has properties that it's very hard for us to understand that they're great-making, or it'd be hard for us to understand in what way you could derive them from, you know, just this definition of God. So, for example, some philosophers struggle with thinking about, does this definition of God allow you to say meaningfully that God is a Trinity? Right, so you would have to argue that being a Trinity is a great-making property. There are some plausible arguments for thinking that being Trinitarian is actually a great-making property, but put those arguments aside entirely. You could say, look, there are some ways that some properties could be categorically grape-making in a way that just the human mind is not capable of fully understanding, right? So there might be properties that are grape-making properties, and it's just beyond our ken that we can't derive or figure out how those are grape-making properties. So for us, those are properties that God might have if we could figure out how they could be grape-making. Or maybe we can get good reasons to think, right? If God tells us that he's a Trinity, well, that gives us good reason to think, we don't know how, that must be a grape-making property too, right? And it's enough that he told us that he is, we can go along with that. But you won't need to derive every property of God from this definition. It's just that for this argument to work, God by definition has to be this. God can't be this plus something else we know not what. He could be, it's just this argument won't work if you think that the concept of God is not as basic as this. So this is maybe the first point in which some people get off right away with the argument. They say, sorry, I'm off. But if you'll follow this bit, then I'll lay out the rest of the way this argument goes. So God is supposed to have all and only the categorically grape-making properties. Plausibly, those would be things like being maximally loving, which will also entail personhood, right? It also entails will. That he will be maximally powerful, so there's nothing that he wills to do that he cannot do, let's say. That he will be maximally knowledgeable, because knowledge is all other things being equal. Knowledge is just a grape-making property, right? It's a categorically grape-making property. And so on and so forth for all of what are called these superlative attributes that God has. So we typically think of God as being omnibenevolent, as being omniscient, as being omnipotent, as having all of these omni properties. And the way to, for this argument at least, the suggestion is you can derive all of these properties and then some by simply saying they fall out of the concept of God if the concept of God just is the concept of a maximally great being, a being that has all and only the great making properties, at least intrinsically, as his intrinsic properties. This is what defines God's attributes. Okay, well, if you follow Anselm this far, then here's the next step of the argument. It seems better for a thing to exist in reality than not to exist. If you imagine something that's very good in a number of ways, and then you add to your concept of the thing by saying it exists, well, that seems to be better than if it didn't exist, right? And it's supposed to be a maximally great thing. So if it's a good thing that it exists, it just falls out of the very concept of it that it should exist. Okay, that's the trick. that's how this argument works. And immediately it invited objections all across the board from people who thought something has gone wrong. That was way too easy. This cannot be a good argument for God's existence. It looks like it's cheating. Something has to have gone wrong somewhere. And the first objector to this argument was actually a fellow Christian monk named Gamilo. And he wrote a treatise called On Behalf of the Fool, because of the biblical passage that says that the fool says in his heart there is no God. So he's playing off of that and saying, okay, all right, Anselm, fine. But on behalf of the fool, it seems like you must have made a mistake somewhere. And Gonillo thinks that the mistake that Anselm is making is that he is throwing these properties onto a thing, great properties onto a thing, and then saying, well, it follows that from the concept of this thing having all of these good properties, that it must exist. So let's run a parody of it then. Suppose I give you an island, and I describe the island to you, and it's just a maximally great island. It has all of the great features, all of the great-making features for an island that you can ever imagine an island having. You can even say that the island is conscious. You can say the island has a will. You can say it's all, whatever you want to say. And then you can show that the maximally great island has to exist. Why? It falls out of the very concept of being a maximally great island, that the island has to exist. Otherwise, it wouldn't be as great as it would be if it existed. So what's the problem here? Like, aren't you doing exactly the same thing, right, Anselm? You're just tacking on to God these properties and then saying, wouldn't it be great if this thing existed? And by definition, we've said this is a maximally great thing, right? God is a maximally great God. And so you should just be able to prove that God exists. But if that works for God, it's going to work for an island. It's going to work for a maximally great pizza. I can imagine an infinitely large pizza with all the toppings that everybody likes, different areas of different toppings that different people prefer, or whatever. And it's just infinitely large. You could never consume it all. And there you go. It's a maximally great pizza, right? But that clearly doesn't exist. So why doesn't it exist? You can't just define something into existence, Ganilo would say. And Anselm thinks Ganilo is just making a mistake. And the mistake he's making is something like this. Ganilo is thinking about God as a thing that happens to be maximally great. It happens to have all of these great-making properties, but that's not the very definition of the concept. If you think about an island, you inherently have to think about a thing that is contingent, right? It has some nature such that it could have been otherwise. And Anselm's concept is going to go and suggest that, no, this thing also has to be necessary. But the important point here is that you're not just throwing properties onto God. Like, you're saying, here's God, and then we're just going to give him all these good properties, and oh, look at that, we get existence out of it, right? Like you can do with the island or the pizza. It's to say, no, there is no deeper part of the concept. It's not like you start with an island and then make it greater and greater, or start with a pizza and then make it greater and greater. The concept of God is nothing other than maximal greatness or perfection. That's it. It's not, you're not tacking that on to God. You're saying that is what the term refers to. That's what it means. So there's something illegitimate about the parody, because the parody imagines a thing and then tacks on these great making properties to it. Whereas Anselm is saying, no, throw that out entirely. Start with the following concept, a maximally great being, and then you can derive all of these properties, including that it has to exist. And you do that without tacking them on to God one at a time. Yeah.
So something that you, when you started showing the cosmological arguments, it was phrased in a logical way, like, if A and then B. That's fine. But here, I feel like I'm missing that in the logical argument.
Right, okay. So there is a structure that I was going to give it when we get a little further, but provisionally, let's say the structure of this argument looks something like this. For any property, if it is a categorically great-making property, then God has it. It is a categorically great-making property to exist. So the property of existing is, in every circumstance, better. At least in this respect, the property is better for a thing to have than to lack. It follows, therefore, that this thing that has all and only these great-making properties has the property of existing. So most ontological arguments are not going to be that simple. Actually, most of them involve like 50 premises instead of like two and then a conclusion. But to break it down, to put it in introductory terms, I would say, you could think of the argument that way. So God is a maximally great being. A maximally great being has all and only categorically great-making properties. existence is a categorically great making property, therefore God has existence.
But it almost feels like you're saying, let God be this, such that blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And in there, in that soup, you put existence.
Right, right.
So you can't end with therefore God exists, because you begin with let God exist, therefore God exists. That's kind of what it is.
Right, okay, so you could imagine running an argument that's like this, but that wouldn't, from which you wouldn't derive existence. Whenever you think about the concept, let's go back to a triangle. You think about a triangle, you can give a definition of it, and then from its definition, you can derive a bunch of features. But just because you can derive a bunch of features from the concept of a triangle, doesn't mean you can derive existence from the concept of a triangle, right? Now, within a certain, let's say a language game, if you act as though triangles exist for the purposes of writing out a logical argument, well, that doesn't tell you that they actually exist. You're kind of going along with that language that kind of ascribes reality to a triangle just to try to derive properties from it. Nobody takes seriously, that's not true. Most people, yeah, except the Platonists. Most people don't take seriously that triangles really exist when you say a triangle has the following properties, right? So having properties is not what most people mean by existing in this metaphysical sense. But the trick of it is, when you're doing the same thing with the concept of God, at least Anselm wants to say, you can show that from the very concept, you derive not only these other properties, like omnibenevolence and so on, you're going to derive existence. How do you derive existence from it? It's not simply by starting with God as a term and then ascribing properties. That's what you do with a triangle, but we don't mean that when we say God exists by the end of the argument. We mean that among the properties you can derive from the concept of a maximally great being is the concept of this being's existing. So that's supposed to be the trick. And of course, this is the point of controversy, is this argument actually legitimate, or is this a philosopher's trick? So it sounds a lot like a philosopher's trick, it feels a lot like a philosopher's trick, but when you think through the concept, it also seems like, yeah, it should be better to exist than not, and the term as we've defined it is maximal greatness, right, the maximally great being. So where exactly is the mistake? Okay, there are lots of arguments in philosophy back and forth about what goes wrong in an ontological argument, and almost nobody was very successful at convincing everybody else that either they proved the argument worked or they proved the argument just doesn't work, right up until Kant in the early modern period. Kant, Immanuel Kant, was the first philosopher who posed really carefully a criticism of this argument that until very, very recently was thought to just nail this argument. It's done, right? He put the last nail in the coffin. He gave us an argument that shows us exactly what the mistake is, and now all of us are smarter for it because we know what the mistake is, but the argument doesn't work, right? And I'm gonna try to give you guys a sense for Kant's objection. Without needing to use his technical language. So we're going to do this as a kind of thought experiment. Suppose I tell you, I'm going to give you information about something, right? You can even close your eyes and imagine this. So I'm going to give you pieces of information about something, and you tell me, or just think about it for yourself, whether the new things that I'm telling you enrich your concept of the thing that we're talking about, or whether it merely gives you information, but that's not really about the thing. Okay, so let's start. Suppose I tell you that there is an apple. Seems like I have given you some idea of what this thing is that enriches your concept of. Suppose I go further and say, this apple is so large that your fingers can't get halfway around it. Okay, seems like maybe I've given you more information about the thing. Suppose I say the apple is green. maybe that does enrich your concept of the thing itself as well. Now suppose I tell you, Emily is thinking about the apple. That seems to tell you something, but is it really something about the apple? Or is it just some piece of information? I can go further and say, there's a bite out of the apple. Okay, have I increased your concept of the thing? Have I enriched that concept or just told you something about the apple? And we can keep going in this way by adding properties one after another. And for some of these, you're probably going to feel like, yeah, that gives me a richer concept of the thing. You've enriched my idea of the thing as I'm imagining or conceiving of it. And other properties are going to feel like, that wasn't really about the thing. It was some property that gives me information about the world or something, but maybe it even gives me information about the apple, right? What did I say? I made up the name. Emily? Emily is thinking about the apple. That tells you something kind of about the apple, but it isn't about the apple's nature or essence or the concept of the apple itself, right? So there are these two different kinds of properties. One of them is a property that enriches your idea of the thing itself, and the other one just gives you some piece of information. Okay, now close your eyes, and I'm going to give you the following property. The apple exists. All right. Now, here's where the division of intuitions gets really interesting. If you think that that last property enriched your concept of the thing itself, raise your hand. Okay? And if you think it just gave you a new piece of information, but that it's not about the apple itself, raise your hand. Right. Right. right.
It's
okay.
About that apple. It's not about the idea of the apple that I already had.
Right. Okay. But you would say that it's a property of the apple.
Right. But it didn't change my conception of it.
Okay. Okay.
My conception is my conception.
Yeah.
I already had all these properties.
Yeah, yeah.
It's red, had the, or green, whatever.
Green, yeah.
See,
but it existing doesn't change my concept.
Okay.
My
right.
concept is in my head.
No, that's right. No. So we're not doing metaphysics yet. We're not inferring the apple's real existence or anything like that. So the question is just, when I told you that it exists, did that enrich your concept of this apple, or did it not enrich your concept of this thing? And this is a division of intuitions that philosophers have had and that Kant focused on. And Kant made a really compelling argument. We won't go through all of it, but he made a pretty definitive argument that if you really think carefully about adding that property to a thing, adding existence, it is not enriching your concept of the thing. It's giving you a piece of information, but that isn't about the apple. It doesn't increase your concept of that apple. So the technical way this gets said in philosophy is existence is not a property, or existence is not a first order predicate, or there are more technical ways of saying it, but the basic idea is it's a kind of second order property, like the property that Emily is thinking about the apple might be a second order property of the apple, but it doesn't inhere the apple. Right? There's nothing about the apple that would be different if you were to move it to a logically possible world where Emily doesn't exist, where she's not thinking about it. That apple is just identical across those two possible worlds. Similarly, the apple would be identical from the actual world to a non-actual possible world. There's no difference between these two apples conceptualized logically. At least, this is what Kant wants to say. For a very long time in philosophy, that was considered the argument that showed that the ontological argument for God's existence is fundamentally conceptually flawed. And the mistake Anselm makes, and that Descartes makes, and all the other proponents of versions of these arguments make, is that they're imagining that existence is a first order property. Yeah, maybe it is better for a thing to exist than not, but existence itself is not a property of a thing in the relevant sense. So existence is not a property. That's how this objection to ontological arguments went. And okay, before I go any further, I want to test or get a feel for your intuitions here. How many of you, now that I've said this, how many of you think Kant was probably right? Yeah? Yes. Maybe. So maybe?
More than you do.
Okay. Okay.
It seems as though that was a complete break.
Okay.
Suddenly to make that seems like it must have divided everything before Kant and after Kant.
Yeah.
Because that's fundamental.
Yes, yeah, it is. And Kant is credited with doing that in a number of different respects in philosophy. He was a very, very careful thinker. Unfortunately not a good writer, but a very, very careful thinker. And this is one of the things that's attributed to him, is he just laid to rest ontological arguments, and at the same time made it clearer to us the distinction between first-order properties, second-order properties, and that existence is not a first-order property. It's not a property about anything. Yeah.
I think I'm probably just not understanding really what a first-order or a second-order property is, but it seems to me that at least in this Kantian viewpoint we have presented, that the concept of a thing is somehow more real than the thing itself. Because when you talk about the apple, you say, oh, the apple is, it's big, it's green, it's known by eminently thing. You know, I was okay, well, I understand the apple. And then you said the apple is real, the apple is, it exists. Well, that to me added information about the apple. Like, I know this is not just a construct, the concept was clear.
Right.
So you did not add anything to the concept of the apple. But this apple existing changes something about the real instance of the apple that is separate from the concept of the apple.
Right.
But I feel like if we believe the concept of the apple as being somehow truer or more real than the actual instance of the apple, then fine. Then we're not adding anything of substance by saying that it exists. But then what comes first, you know, like the concept or the instance?
Right. Okay, good. So one way of reading what you just said is just to say your intuition is just pre-Kantian. So Kant gives you his argument that existence is not a predicate. It convinces virtually every philosopher, not every philosopher, because there's always at least one. Not every philosopher agrees, but most philosophers agree Kant is just right. And you would then say, no, I don't buy it. I'm sorry. He didn't make his argument well enough. Now, I'm not giving his full technical arguments, so maybe it's worth looking more carefully at what Kant actually says and how he argues. But for what it's worth, you can just say, I'm not persuaded that existence is not a property in the relevant sense. And that will just mean that for you, the argument is on the table. Kant didn't do anything to defeat the argument for you, right? I actually think that Kant's criticism is right. I think that existence is not a first-order property. He's exactly right that a number of different versions of the ontological argument go wrong right here. So I'm sympathetic to Kant, but you needn't be. There are entire systems of logic. Kripke developed a mode of logic that does this, that just uses existence as a first-order predicate. And you could refer to those systems and say, look, it's perfectly consistent to have a logical framework where existence is treated as a kind of first-order property. I think that is the real logic, right? The actual logic that describes reality. I think existence is that kind of property. So for me, there's no problem. And I can show that God exists can be derived right from the concept. I don't consider Kant's objection very good. You're probably going to have a very hard time convincing most people, though, especially an atheist, of that, because most people hear Kant's objection, some version of it, and think, yeah, Kant seems to be right about that. So it's just to note your intuitions might differ from most on that.
Well, I'm not married to the idea of opposing the kind
right.
of point of view.
Right.
I just don't really get why it's... Yeah, like I said, maybe it's a language. Maybe I just don't really know what you mean by first order versus second order. property.
Yeah. It's easier to get a sense of what that means by just thinking, by giving examples. Like when I said the apple is green, that seems to be a first order property. When I said Emily is thinking about the apple, that's a second order property. Okay, well, if you just keep going with that, the easiest way that I know how to articulate the difference is, does the property enrich your concept of the thing, or does it not enrich your concept of the thing per se? Right?
Well, not the concept.
See, this is where I'm having trouble with you. I think when you said it exists, it went from theoretical to real. And
right.
And that's what made it in my mind enriched.
Right.
So it did enrich the concept.
I think it was like, is this the what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It seems to me as though we're living right now in a time where being able, like we have such an illustration of that with the internet and with the ability that it seems much easier to conceive of something that is not real and yet we all believe in something that isn't. So it seems like an easy metaphor for that concept in a way.
For the concept of existence?
No, properties.
Okay. Yeah. So it could be that we blur the lines in some ways when we're thinking about things, especially with social media and the reality of... I was going to say the reality of things online. So there are special ways of speaking about, like, does a website exist? Right. Okay. So that's the kind of question.
It's conceptual.
Right. And so there are different ways of answering that. You probably don't mean the website exists in the way the table exists, right? But then maybe we are, in some sense, blurring the lines enough that people today are less clear, or think it's less clear, what existence really means than they would have been before Kant or even in Kant's day. So that could be.
Yeah. We say that the Kantian idea is that when the apple exists, it's not a property of the apple. The existence of the apple is a property of the universe, that it contains that apple.
Exactly. Yeah.
That apple, only things that actually exist have actual properties.
Right.
So
right.
When the apple actually exists, it's green and whatever. And if it actually doesn't exist, with the idea that it's green or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is whether our universe contains this apple.
Right. And actually, I mean, philosophers would want to take it back from universe to world again and say, when I say the apple exists, I'm just saying that there is a logically possible world that happens to have the property of being actual and that the apple occupies it. Right? A very technical, otherwise useless language, but
exactly.
So I've given you guys a sense of how the ontological logical argument is supposed to go, and I've given you a sense for how the principal objection to it, philosophically, historically, has been issued. What happened to the ontological argument, though, is that over the last century or so, it's undergone a kind of renaissance. People are picking the ontological argument back up again, because, and they've done this in two different ways. We're going to talk about one of these two ways, because I don't think we can get through both of them. But the basic way in which the argument was resurrected, you might say, is to forget this talk about existence, right, as a property. Let's run the ontological argument without existence needing to be a property at all. Let's start over. God is supposed to be a maximally great being. What is one of the properties entailed by that? Well, one of the properties is going to be that he is metaphysically necessary. If he were not metaphysically necessary, if he were contingent, it seems like he would be less great than he otherwise would be. In contingency, is itself a great-making property. And it's a categorically great-making property. So, God is a maximally great being. A maximally great being exists necessarily. for a thing to exist necessarily means that it populates all logically possible worlds. There is no logically possible world in which that thing does not exist. If there were, then it would be a contingent thing. It would be a thing that exists in some but not all logically possible worlds. Okay, here comes the newly controversial premise. It's possible that God exists. What does it mean for something to be possible? It means that it does exist in at least one logically possible world. To be possible means that you occupy at least one logically possible world. Okay. If a metaphysically necessary being exists in one logically possible world, it follows that a metaphysically necessary being exists in every logically possible world, because to be metaphysically necessary means to exist across all logically possible worlds. We didn't say the word existence once, but now you have, from the concept of God, derived, and this is referred to as a modal ontological argument, because it's strictly logical in each of its steps. Okay, before I go any further, how do you guys feel about that? Do you feel like it's a trick, or that it seems to be right, or any thoughts?
Can you say it again?
Yes, yeah. So,
this is... clarify what you mean by metaphysical, why it's...
Yeah, okay. So I'll start over. So remember, in logically possible worlds are full descriptions of ways the world could be. If it's logically possible, if it's not contradictory, if it's a way the world could be, then there is a logically possible world in which the following is true, whatever it is. To be possible means to occupy or be instantiated in at least one such possible description of reality, a logically possible world. To be necessary means to exist across all logically possible worlds. If there were some worlds in which something didn't exist, then it's not necessary, because it could have failed to exist, because there's some logically possible world in which it doesn't. So to be metaphysically necessary just entails existing across the entirety of logical space. Okay. Is the property of being necessary in this way, metaphysically necessary, is that a great making property? Well, it seems to be. It seems like it would be better to have than to lack. If you're the kind, if something is the kind of thing that exists in some possible worlds but not all of them, it seems like whatever other good we might say about that thing, it would be even better if it existed across all the possible worlds, right? So you imagine a morally perfect being existing across only some possible worlds. Well, that seems less good than a morally perfect being existing across all of them, existing such that it could not fail to exist, right? So this is how the argument runs now. It starts off with God is a maximally great being. A maximally great being has all and only the categorically great-making properties. One such property is existing metaphysically. To exist metaphysically means existing across all logically possible worlds. It's possible that God exists. Seems possible. If God does possibly exist, then he exists in one logically possible world. But from the very concept of God as a metaphysically necessary being, you can then just derive, if something is possibly necessary, it just is necessary. If a necessary being possibly exists, then it exists in not just one logically possible world, but across all of them. So that is how the argument goes.
Well, it's logical.
Right. Yes. It gets accused of that in both good and bad ways. But yes, it is it's a strictly logical, and this is why people refer to it as a modal ontological argument. It's an entirely new kind of ontological argument. It doesn't even bother arguing with Kant about whether existence is a great-making property. It just says metaphysical necessity is a great-making property, and that's all we need. The only point in this argument, and this is really the controversial premise, is the premise that says it's possible that God exists. The reason this is controversial is that when we think about possibility, we're thinking in terms of conceptual possibility or epistemic possibility. Like, we don't know that it is the case, and we don't know that it's not the case, so we'll treat it as an open question. And that's usually what we mean by possible. But the sense of possible being used in this argument occupies one logically, at least one logically possible world. And so this, what's called the possibility premise, is what some philosophers will attack and say, this is illegitimate. You can't go from it seems possible to me to it is metaphysically possible. And that's the move that the new argument makes that's now controversial. Just because it seems possible to you doesn't mean it's possible in the way the argument is using. The argument is using possible in this rich metaphysical sense, and we have to build a bridge from it seems like it could be all the way to it is metaphysically possible. But if you concede that point, the argument works, right? And so virtually everyone now admits that the argument itself is a logically valid argument, that there's really no fundamental conceptual flaw, and the only problem is, can you know or can you justify the possibility premise, right? And this goes back to Thomas Aquinas, actually, because when he first thought of this argument, he thought the argument is logically valid, makes no mistakes, even way, way back before Kant. The argument is logically valid, it makes no mistakes, and it's sound, which means all of its premises are true, so its conclusion follows. So Aquinas thought this is a sound argument that is worthless. And the reason he thought it was worthless is he thought no human being is in a position to know that the essence of God involves existence. You can't know God's essence in the way required for you to know that premise of the argument. So from God's perspective, is the argument sound? Yes. Does it work? Yes. Is it useful for us? Absolutely not. That was Aquinas' view. But there's nothing wrong with the argument except that it's useless for us. We can't learn anything from it. So this was his criticism of it. In more modern terms, the way to maintain something like Aquinas' position is to say, yeah, the argument is perfectly valid. It works, right? And if you conceive the possibility premise, you're going to get all the way to God exists in reality. Easy. The question is, can you know that premise to be true? Can you know the possibility premise? Or do you have good reasons for thinking that that is true? And so this is now the point of controversy with the argument.
So did Thomas Aquinas feel like it was effrontery to presume that such a thing? Is it something that is outside of what is humble? Was that kind of the argument?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. So Aquinas thought that the way to appropriately work your way up to God's existence, you can prove God's existence. You can even prove these other things about God. But the problem is you can't skip to the end. Like, you can prove that God is metaphysically necessary. You can prove that his essence involves existence. But the only way to prove that, Aquinas thinks, is by pointing to features of the world and then inferring the necessary explanation up to God. But remember, the ontological argument is working backwards. It's saying, forget all of that stuff about the world that you learn from experience. Can you derive it just from the concept? And Aquinas thinks, yeah, this argument could prove to God that God exists. The problem is, you can't know the important premise in the argument. You're not in a position to know that, right? And so he thinks the atheist is just going to say, okay, let's run a parody of the argument. So I just said, if something is possibly true, if it occupies at least one logically possible world, space that is part of the logical space, and it's metaphysically necessary, then it occupies all such space. Okay, so let's run a parody of the argument. It's logically possible that God not exist. God is a necessary being. If God exists at all, then he exists across all logically possible worlds. If there is one logically possible world where God does not exist, it follows that God exists in no logically possible worlds. Therefore, you have an ontological argument for atheism. Okay? And that argument is actually given in the literature, that it's an almost perfect parody. And the only point of contention is, when philosophers talk about this, they'll say, is the possibility of existing or occupying a logically possible world, is that in some relevant sense different from the possibility of not occupying a possible world? Should we think that when you're positing something, right, you're actually saying something positive about the way the world could be, that you should, as a default assumption, presume the possibility of a thing instead of the impossibility of a thing? Which is more intellectually appropriate? If you don't know, should you just assume that it's possible until somebody shows you the contradiction? Or can you assume that it's impossible? Can you assume that it's possibly impossible, and therefore that it's just impossible? The atheistic version of this argument presumes it seems possible that it be impossible that God exists, so it's impossible that God exists. And defenders of the ontological argument are going to say, there's something different about saying it's possible that it not exist versus saying it's possible that it actually exists. That second one, where you're positing an actual existence, or that it actually occupies a possible world, that seems different, and it seems like we should give that one the benefit of the doubt. If we didn't do that, then forget the question of God's existence. Modal logic would be a lot harder to do, because typically in modal logic, when you hear about a thing, even if you haven't made sense of it yet, right, a gobbledygook exists. Okay, well, I don't know what that is, but I'm going to just assume it's possible, which means it occupies at least one possible world, and then we'll see what we can derive from it. We never do the opposite and assume that it's possibly impossible, therefore it's impossible, and then just cut it out of our logically possible thinking. We never do that for anything else. Why would we do it here? The other thing you can say is that maybe there are reasons for thinking that it is possible and that you can support that premise. Here's one such reason. It never seems to be the case that people have a concept of a thing that's logically coherent and that is not logically possible. We have a logically coherent concept of God. Doesn't it follow that it should just be considered a possible thing, that it occupies at least one possible world? If it does, you've got your ontological argument back again, right? And you can get all the way to the conclusion that God exists in reality and exists necessarily. There are other ways of doing this too. So Brian Lefdow at Oxford was working on an argument when he was there, trying to think of, well, maybe you could infer from experience, right? So forget just your concept of a thing. People never seem to have an experience of a logically impossible object. So you might seem in a dream state to have an experience of a purple elephant, but that's a logically possible thing, even if it's not actual. But you never dream and seem to have an experience of a square circle. That just doesn't happen, right? And it can't happen. Okay, well, dream or not, plenty of religious people seem to have an experience of God. shouldn't it follow that God possibly exists? And if God possibly exists, that gives you your possibility premise. So again, the ontological argument, everything really hinges on this possibility premise and the inference from if something is metaphysically possible and possibly necessary, it just follows that it is necessary. Okay, I've given you guys, now we're basically out of time, so I did do that within an hour, so I gave you guys a taste for how that argument goes. I hope you guys like it. None of the other arguments are going to be like this. The ontological argument is entirely unique. Everyone kind of loves it or hates it. Very few people feel ambivalent about it, so you can feel strongly either way about the argument. But at least now you get a sense of how it works, and hopefully you agree with me that this argument, even if it doesn't work, even if it's a terrible argument, let's say, even if it were, its one clear advantage is that it helps us get clearer on our concept of God than any other argument helps us to get. So I think it's useful for that, even if for no other reason, I think it's useful for that. Yeah.
So I'm still on the apple thing.
yeah.
So the apple, when you say, let's say it's green or whatever, you call that a primary?
Yeah, a first order property.
A first order property.
Yeah.
And when you said it exists, it was second order property.
Yes.
So does that mean if someone's describing me and they say, let's say arms, legs, lungs, brain, whatever,
mm-hmm.
but then if they say soul, consciousness, spirit, that's secondary?
Not necessarily. So suppose that you are in pain, let's say, and I say Luigi is in pain, that statement could still be the being in pain could still be a first order property of you, because it's genuinely about you. If I say you have a soul, that still seems to be genuinely about you. If I say you are love, that's the kind of property that seems to be about the world in which you occupy, right? The world you occupy, but it isn't really about you in the same way. And if you agree with that intuition, then you'll want to say that that would be a second order property as opposed to the first ones that are first order. First order are really about you. Second order are, you might think of it this way, second order would be how you relate to everything else in the world. Whereas first order is just, without reference to anything else in the world, what are you?
Okay, I don't know if I'm going somewhere wrong here, but what if you say Luigi's freedom?
Okay.
Is that like a first order? Because it's about me?
It could be.
Or would you say that's second order?
So it depends how you mean first order. If you mean something if you mean something like you have free will,
right,
that would be a first order property.
Okay.
If you mean something like you have legal freedom, that seems clearly a second order property.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And then third order?
Good question. No, I think most philosophers would just say that anything that is, like if there's a property of a property of a property of a thing, you'd still just call that a second order, right? You could call that a third, fourth, fifth order, but at that point the distinction is useless, so you would normally just divide between first order properties and second order properties.
So you mentioned possibilities, so is there a place for probability in any of these theories?
Yes, not in the ontological argument, because the ontological argument doesn't want to conclude to probably God exists. Other arguments will do that. The ontological argument wants God exists, period. That's the end of the argument. That's the goal. If you get to 99% probable, whatever else you're doing, it's not an ontological argument. Ontological arguments want 100% proof just with reference to the concept. That's it. Anything less, ontological argument has failed.
Let's find out which Wednesday he's going to do it. You can fly back. I trip on the possible and one then possible for all, because to me it sounds like possible one probable for all.
Mm.
I don't. Yeah, it's not intuitive for me to think that way.
Okay. Fair enough. I'll try one last time very, very quickly to warm you to that. So the idea of being logically possible is that you do exist in at least one logically possible world. To be logically necessary means that you exist across all logically possible worlds. So to say that God is logically possible means that he occupies at least one logically possible world. And to say that it's a property of God, from the very concept of God, that he be necessary, right, that his existence be necessary, metaphysically necessary, it follows that he's the kind of thing that, if it exists at all, exists across all logically possible worlds. So to go back to an example I gave before with numbers, right? So there are some people who are mathematical Platonists. They believe that numbers really exist. So for those people, for the people who are Platonists in that way, they will say the number two exists not just in our world, it exists in so fundamental a way that it's metaphysically necessary. So if it exists in at least one possible world, it will follow that the number two exists across all logically possible worlds in exactly the same way. So you can run an ontological argument for numbers. You can run an ontological argument for laws of logic. They're still controversial, but they're less controversial than running an ontological argument for God. That's the really controversial one.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, thanks.
Would it still be logically sound to reorganize the argument a little bit differently? Because in my head, I think of it like, first, for the ontological argument, first, any possible necessary being must exist. Like
right.
That.
Yes.
Just like any possible necessary being must exist.
Yep.
That's statement one. Statement two. Like, God is, but by his very nature, his very essence, necessary.
Yep.
Therefore, if God is possible, then God exists.
Yes. Yep. That is the modal ontological argument.
Okay.
That is exactly it. That's exactly what that's exactly what defenders of the argument said. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. Awesome. All right. We've done lots tonight, so I'm pretty happy. I might have mentioned Platonism before. Before everyone goes, can we also
reach.
Oh, sure. Carry on conversation in a moment. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you, Lord, for your presence with us this evening. As we depart from this space now, we ask that you bless us throughout the remainder of this evening and guide us safely home. Do not let the learning and conversations of this gathering die, but instead may they continue to ruminate within us and bear fruit in our ministries throughout the year until we find ourselves together again. We ask this in the name of Jesus and in the power of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
In the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Thank you all for coming.